Session number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 20.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 20. What were you doing in Wiltshire, Mr. Hawksworth?
Well, the battalion, having arrived home from Greece, were dispatched to this hutted camp at Monkton Farley, which is a picturesque little hamlet on the outskirts of Bath, near to Bath Hampton in Wiltshire. Close by was an underground ammunition depot manned by War Department police, several of whom we made friends with at the local pub. We spent quite a pleasant time there, most of the time which we occupied in sending chaps off on embarkation leave, including myself, and something like 3 months was spent there. The local villagers accepted us. They'd had troops in these barracks during the war, but there'd been a gap of something like 2 years whilst they'd lain vacant. The sergeant's mess accommodation was little or nothing, so we made our base with full acquiescence of the local landlord at the local village pub, the King's Arms. The manager of whom I visited since, who is now living in Bath and nearing his 100th birthday, Arthur Butt by name. And so, towards the end of the 3 months' stay, we'd all been rested and rehabilitated and shaken the sands of grief from our shoes. We were told that our next port of call would be Dortmund in Germany, and we would become part of the Rhine Army in Tudiv.
Was the constitution of the battalion changing all the time as you got from farther and farther into peacetime situation?
No, the formation remained exactly the same. Possibly the introduction of a company called Support Company had come in about that time. A support company previously known as D Company. This company were responsible for providing local battalion cover with heavy weapons such as mortars, machine guns and anti-tank guns at that stage.
When did you leave for Germany?
We left on a troop train for Parkston Quay near Harwich on the 4th of January 1949.
Do you recall the journey into Germany?
Yes, it was quite interesting. We boarded the train at the Hook of Holland and passed through Holland, places like Arnhem of great repute, until we finally went across the border through Bochum and Bocholt and the industrial area, Essen, which is also well known, who produced a lot of the German guns for the war, until we finally arrived at the town of Dortmund, which is in North Rhine-Westphalia. We were then down for regular garrison duties and more or less back on a complete peacetime footing.
How did you find the Germans? How did they receive you and what impressions did you get?
We were told during a series of lectures locally by a visiting officer from the Royal Army Education Corps that, generally speaking, the Germans didn't like us, nor did they dislike us. They were just so bloody happy that the whole lot had finished, and that although an enemy army, literally speaking, was in occupation of part of their country, as long as they were allowed to go about their business then suffer no interference from us, they were quite content. I wouldn't say that we were welcomed with open arms. Indeed, we had a civilian company working in and around the barracks, including some Polish refugees and German nationals. But they kept themselves very much to themselves, did what they were expected of, and things went on just like that. There was, however, we found later, in villages in and around Dortmund, a distinctive pro-communist attitude. And more, on more than one occasion, occasional clashes occurred in the local pubs and bars down in the town.
Is that between the civilians, the clashes, not the army?
No, this was between the army, soldiers of various regiments, and these chaps who were obviously looking for a fight.
You didn't fraternise then to a great deal?
I believe that by this time the strict order of non-fraternisation had been removed, and, well, in fact, it must have, since I remember that... gradually, on our next guest nights in the Sounds Mess, which we had many and were well known, German lady friend Fräuleins were in evidence, and things went from not so bad to good. In fact, at least one of our sergeants, Sergeant Durham by name, married a local German girl.
What state was Dortmund and the surrounding countryside in? Because the war hadn't been finished too long.
Well, we'd noticed on our way into Germany, having passed through Holland, which had all received a certain amount of damage, every railway station through the Dutch border towards Dortmund had been almost flattened. A terrific amount of work must have been put in a very short space of time in order to get the trains through. But extremely severe damage was noticed on both sides of the line, and the troops, there was very little chatter between the troops as we neared our destination at Dortmund. Most of the time was taken up looking at the terrible damage that had been wreaked by our bombers, I suppose. The town of Essen was a terrible sight, and I'll never forget that. And of course, the Rhine was not far away. Bochum, the chemical centre of the chemical industry, ICI and people like that had been almost squashed. Dortmund itself had received damage in and around the centre of the town, certainly around the area of the railway station, and not far away, the town of Hamm, which was a very important rail junction and marshalling yard, had been totally destroyed. So, the countryside surrounding appeared to have remained untouched, which spelt good for the accuracy of the bomb aimers, whoever they had been. Near to Dortmund was a village called Appelbeck, and another one called Schwerte, where not a windowpane had been shattered. And in fact, the barracks in Dortmund, in which we were billeted, a first-class accommodation, I might say, had previously been occupied by an anti-aircraft regiment of the German army, who were the creme of the creme at that time. And so we were in a first-class situation as far as barrack accommodation was concerned.
What were the duties and responsibilities you were carrying out?
Well, the various duties came under, the banner of garrison duties. There were various depots to be guarded, round the clock in some cases. But there were two gunner units closely... situated to our barracks, the 40th Field Regiment Royal Artillery and the 10th Anti-Tank Regiment of the Royal Artillery, with whom we became good friends, played a lot of sport, enjoyed each other's mess companies, and got on absolutely fine together. So the duties were shared. The gunners, the light infantry mucked in, and the garrison duties were performed. A lot of sport was encouraged. I've never known so much sport. I would consider that, except for the times when we were on combined exercises, of which there were of great magnitude, most afternoons were devoted entirely to football, hockey, or some other form of sport.
What happened next then, Mr. Hawksworth?
Well, we spent the best part of a year or so in Dortmund. the last exciting thing that happened in Dortmund, as far as I was concerned, was that my company won hands down the intercompany boxing competition, and followed that up by winning hands down the battalion intercompany drill competition. Colonel Hanmer, who was at that time commanding the battalion, decided that my company, B Company, having won the drill competition, would carry out the duties of advance party to Berlin, which was our next port of call.
Who was your company commander?
My company commander at that time was Major Glanville. Bob Glanville was not a Durham Light Infantry man. I believe he came originally from the Somerset Light Infantry, or possibly the Duke of Cornwall. But he was a big man, a nice, jovial sort of fella, and all the company were extremely fond of him.
You moved to Berlin. How did you find that?
Well, my company went up, as I say, the advance party to relieve the Manchester Regiment, who were in occupation of the Wavell Barracks, which were to be ours eventually. Berlin was a terrific place. The duties were similar to those we'd performed in Dortmund on a garrison basis. There were more infantry battalions, of course, in Berlin. We were proud to wear the distinctive Berlin flash, which was the black circle with an inverted one, with the word Berlin beneath it. Not every battalion at that time had been to Berlin, of course, because there hadn't been sufficient time. So we were one of the early battalions in, and possibly one of the first light infantry battalions to be seen in garrison duties there. The sporting facilities were out of this world. Of course, the at one time Olympic Stadium of world renown was in Berlin, and quite a lot of time was spent in and around the sporting areas. A terrific swimming area, football, and acres of playing fields. Quite a terrific place. There was a lot of ceremonial drill and occasions mounted in Berlin. It was an attractive place for visiting persons of higher authority to come to. And so we were being constantly visited by Lord this or General soever. And since I've just mentioned the officers of high rank, it was I remember now that Eddie Smith, alias General Sir Peter de la Villiers, was dispatched into my company whilst we were in Berlin. And
where did you get the Eddie Smith from?
Well, one can imagine possibly Private Smith from Hartlepool asking to refer to Lieutenant Sir Peter de la Villiers, or at that time he wasn't a sir, but Mr. de la Villiers was a bit of a handful, so he became Mr. Smith. Someone attached Eddie, I don't know where that came from. But I believe even to this day, in mess functions and elsewhere, when he's present, he's referred to as Eddie, with a tin shoulders.
Was there any change in attitudes to the Germans in Berlin as to others you'd met elsewhere?
Yes, I noticed, and I think most other people did, there was a distinct difference. One might have thought of a different population altogether. When one looks back at history and realises what a terrific beating the Berliners had, and particularly the people in Spandau, the area in which we were barracked, had a beating from the Russians, and the women had been roughly handled, as one reads, and so they were delighted to be occupied by a real friendly force. Fraternisation in Berlin had been lifted eventually, and a good time was being had by all. In fact, it was these first two or three years post-war, there was a lot of hard work done and certainly a lot of training done. Chaps were leaving and chaps were coming, and people were changing all the time, but every effort was made to ensure that the few that were left and the few who had been through it were absolutely determined to make up for the bad times we've been through.
The changes in the company, which you said were fairly rapid. Well, again, what were the standard of new people coming in?
Well, by this time we were getting recruits who were passing through our own regimental depot and being trained to our high standards, and the results were shown. We were, of course, glad to receive them. the bad old days, if they can be called such, when one had reinforcements coming in from all over the bloody place, from various different regiments, and with different regimental customs, had finished. And so we were now light infantry, real light infantry men once again. And in fact, it was in the days of Salonika when a decision had been made to brigade the five light infantry regiments, sort of band us together in early 1947, I believe. This meant that should a transfer be immediately necessary, a light infantry man being transferred would eventually find himself certainly back in a light infantry regiment, one of the five.
Were these very largely national servicemen?
My company, since you asked this question, my company in Korea consisted mainly of national servicemen, and I couldn't speak too highly of them. They were a grand set of chaps. And although they all went when the opportunity arose, most of them went anyway, they were very sorry to leave us.
You said that you were operating in Berlin in the Spandau area. Did you get involved with the prison there?
Yes, the main garrison duty in Berlin was a company strength guard on the Spandau prison. It was a United Nations responsibility, and at that time contained several nasty types. The Americans, French, and ourselves took turns in mounting guards on this prison. My company wasn't called upon to take a tour of duty of this particular nature, but I visited on one occasion, a matter of interest, and it was a duty which, although was a very strict and important one, was one of great interest.
You would come into contact with American, French. Did you meet Russians?
No. At that time, of course, the wall hadn't even been thought about, so one could freely walk around, but there was a Russian sector, a Russian sector and a Russian zone. The Russian zone was out of bounds. The Russian sector could be visited on production of a pass. We weren't discouraged from taking advantage of this match, but we were advised not to dwell too long. I never went through. I was content to enjoy myself in the British sector, of which there was ample room. In fact, I was surprised when I found out that one could take a company on a route march lasting a full day without ever leaving the British sector. It was a massive circumference, including the famous Grunewald Forest and the Lake. Lots of us joined the garrison yacht club. Other chaps joined the fishing club. I never saw any fish, but there were excellent canteen facilities, I believe, in the fishing club area.
The Germans, obviously, were really beginning to recover from the war, but conditions must have been pretty hard for them. How did they cope, and particularly as it involved yourselves, with food, for example? Was there a black market that was rampant? Were there any problems with stealing and gangs and this kind of thing?
I never experienced any serious pilfering or robberies involving our equipment, but certainly there was a flourishing black market in the area. The main type of currency, I remember right, was Nescafe. And contrary to all rules, certain people were known to be making a small fortune disposing of Nescafe through these devious means.
Did the battalion and its men get involved with the civilian population in an assisting way of food?
Yes, I seem to remember that at least twice during our short stay there, we arranged children's parties, one in Spandau and one shared by some other regiment on the Mayfield in the Olympic Stadium, so that we made every effort to create a friendly atmosphere between the soldiers and the civilians. Certainly in our area, again in Spandau, they were only too pleased to stand alongside us and share anything they had. Although, as you say, they had a damn hard time all through the war, particularly during the end when when the Russians ransacked the Spandau area, there was little material damage to be seen, but the population, most of them, still showed signs on the faces that had a hard time.
Have you any other outstanding memories of Berlin and Germany?
No, it was the main thing that springs to mind is the fact that we were once more able to keep ourselves clean. We had our proper standard supply of equipment. One wasn't looking over one's shoulder all the time, and gradually we began to realise that the bloody war had finished, and it must have taken about 2 years for this to really sink in. We got back to the spit and polish days, which after all is part of a soldier's life. The morale was extremely high. We were a popular battalion within the garrison, who always had been, wherever we've been. We visited each other's messes, all ranks, and we held our sports days and the odd carnival, to which we invited the local Germans. So my memories of our stay in Germany, short as it was, were none but good.
When did you realise or hear that you were to move and that possibly Korea was your next destination?
Well, towards the end of our stay in Berlin, we arranged the inevitable intercompany boxing competition. And having entered the gymnasium where this competition was to be staged, I and several other elder colleagues of mine were surprised to notice the appearance of Crackers May, who sat himself down in the front row amongst the officers, grinning as usual at everyone in sight, and at the first opportunity rose to his feet and to the thunderous applause and announced that he'd been given the privilege of informing us that we were once more going to tackle some other buggers, this time in Korea. There was the 30 minutes or 30 second silence, and he said, "And if you think I'm bloody taking it, you're mistaken. You've got to have another job coming." In the event, Colonel Peter Jeffries was brought out of retirement and took us to Korea.
How was this done then? Where did you go to? What date did you leave Germany?
We left Germany in the middle of 1952. And landed up at Barnard Castle in County Durham, much to the delight of the locals, who were immediately sent off on leave as fast as possible, leaving a small rear party behind with me in charge. During the next couple of months or so, we carried out individual training, and the usual routine. The barracks were good. The barracks were extremely good. Near to the small market town of Barnard Castle, which was frequented by the soldiery, and then, in readiness for our eventual dispatch to Korea, we were sent up onto the North Yorkshire Moors for a fortnight, with little or nothing to sustain ourselves as part of the rigorous training. We cooperated with tanks as part of our training. We did the usual section, platoon, and company attacks. We fired our courses on the open ranges at Bellaby Camp near Catterick, and generally had a hard time. By the time we came back, we were all as fit as lops and ready to go anywhere. On our return from the training area to Bransworth Camp, where we were to stay before in training for the troop ship, we marched from the disbursement area outside Bishop Auckland. We marched through Bishop Auckland along the road and eventually into the camp at Bransworth.
The training that you had, was that basically a mobile kind of training, fire and movement?
Yes. We had evidently been chosen to occupy a part which was most hilly, which fitted in with the future operations, I suppose. And so a lot of it entailed advance covering fire operation, up and down hills, and extended marches by night. But quite a bit of emphasis was placed on the Infantry Tank Corporation aspect.
Looking back now, did that training prepare you for what you actually did experience in Korea?
Well, as far as the actual fighting is concerned, no, it didn't. Although one didn't know what to expect, but by the time he arrived at the battlefront in Korea, things had become bogged down. In fact, it was completely static and remained so during our stay there. But nevertheless, these training exercises are bound not only to refresh one's memory as to fire and movement practices, but to keep one body fit. This aspect of the training no doubt helped us, because once in the line in Korea, apart from the few weeks out occasionally for a rest, one could move about freely and was confined to the trench system.
Had your weapons changed since the ones that you were using at the end of the war?
One interesting addition, as far as the infantry weapons concerned, was the introduction of a small machine gun called the Patchett. The maker's name was the Stirling machine gun. This was a much improved version, light machine gun, introduced in order to replace the Sten, by which time had become antiquated, although some 15 marks of Sten gun were eventually produced. This Patchett we took with us to Korea on troop testing arrangements, with instructions to give it a bashing, use it, put it through its most rigorous tests, and report in due course, but on no count to be taken through the wire. We didn't want the chinks to get hold of these weapons at that time. I had one personally and gave it a thorough testing, including on one occasion total immersion in a frozen well for 24 hours, and within a matter of minutes of recovery, firing effectively.
You were obviously aware that you were going into some kind of fighting situation. What were your feelings about this?
Well, by this time, of course, we had almost a complete change of men. I had, during my service in Rhine Army, in Dortmund, in fact, signed on to complete 22 years' service, a matter which had slipped everyone's mind until one Sunday lunchtime session in the mess, when I was told I should be wearing a bowler hat. This error was rapidly rectified the following day, and the adjutant dragged me in and got my thumbprint on the paper. But we were numbed, I suppose, by the news that we were going to be flung into action again. But there were few of us who had been through the previous lot in any case. And we now had possibly two-thirds of National Service soldiers with us, whose fate hung in the balance. And there were great debates in the various canteens before I left Berlin as to who would miss the boat and who would be just managing to get on it. And in the event, about half of our National Servicemen qualified for discharge, but the remainder came along, and I might have made a very fine job of it.
Your family, your mother, of course, now that she's a widow, how did she take the news?
Well, she was much older now, of course, and I think she considered that because I had a crown on my arm, I was immune to enemy fire, or something of that nature. I assured her that Sergeant Mady didn't walk behind the soldiers all the time, and occasionally, in fact, had her run in front. And her last word to me was, "Anyway, be careful, darling."